Welcome to the Rent to Rent Success Podcast, the only podcast entirely dedicated to helping you achieve rent to rent success. We talk about the ethical way to get you started in property without buying it. This is our place to inspire each other to believe bigger, to be bolder, and to be game changers for good. Property investors and sisters Stephanie and Nikki Taylor are your guides on this exciting ride. Let's start up the engines and get ready to fly. Hello, hello, hello. It's Stephanie here and welcome to episode 85 of the Rent to Rent Success Podcast. And today you are in for a treat. I cannot wait to get into this episode with you. We have with us Sam Norris, the property investors broker. Now, I know Sam. I met him in person, I think it was 2020. Is that last year? At PIP. It was the property investors meeting that was just before the lockdown happened. And ever since then, I've been following Sam on Instagram. He puts out incredible content that's helping property investors to be able to get the finances they need to do their property magic. So Sam has been involved in property since 2007. He started Grand Union Finance during the pandemic to help property investors and developers, because for many of us, it's you run out of money, and Sam is the man who can make it happen and help you make your property magic. Sam is host of the Game of Loans podcast, which is probably the best podcast name ever. And it's a fantastic podcast. I was just saying, Sam, it's like you're listening to two friends talking, but he has a wide range of developers all talking about how property is and what it means for them and the finance aspect of it. And his big love, of course, is his family and the Saracens Rugby Club, which is actually a bit of an obsession. So welcome to the show, Sam Norris.
Thanks for having me, Steffi. That was quite the intro. I've got to back it up.
So, Sam, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I mean, you did a pretty good job, but yeah, I've been in the game, as they say, since 2007. Not the best time, if you remember, to really get into property, and especially finance, because no sooner had I passed my exams to actually give advice to people on their mortgages, the credit crunch came along and swallowed all the cash that I was apparently meant to go out and find these people. So I had a torrid time for about 3 years or so, which actually led me to because my dad's a builder, to actually do my first development with my dad, because I thought, hey, I'm not making much money through mortgages. Why don't I throw myself into something slightly different and come back to it? And we did a really great project. And actually it was that project that really opened my eyes to the world of development finance in particular, bridging, that kind of thing. And in that time, really spoke to quite a number of investors and developers. And I realized, hang on a second, I'm spending all this time at the moment helping, very rewardingly, helping first-time buyers and the such get mortgages. But actually, what I really loved was the development side of things, the investor side of things. And really from then, from sort of 2010 onwards, I've been really trying to focus more and more of my attention on investors and developers, which obviously has culminated in this time last year. It's our 1 year anniversary of starting Grand Union Finance, with the sole goal of being the kind of one-stop shop for investors when it comes to finance. So looking after not only the mortgage side of things, which, as we know, can be complicated on its own, but also looking at bridging finance, development finance, commercial mortgages, which can be used not just for commercial property, but for residential property too, in the right circumstances. And really having that, what I like to think, that kind of breadth of knowledge of not just being a human calculator, but actually being able to find the right finance products to match the right property investment strategies. And I think that's the real key. And that's where we fit our little niche in the market. And yeah, it's going pretty well so far. So, and you mentioned my obsession with Saracens. That's the only time in the week where nobody is allowed to call me is when Saracens are playing, and that includes the wife.
Right. Okay. Well, we consider ourselves told. What I love about that story is actually that you have the experience yourself as a developer. And so is your dad, was your dad do a lot of property investment or development, or was that just a little...
No, that was quite a sort of a bit of a foray, if you like. We haven't done it for quite some time, mainly because very shortly after that, my dad actually went into business with someone else. And obviously then he had to consider that he didn't have necessarily the freedom of just being able to go off and do a project whenever he wanted, because he was working with somebody else. And I actually, shortly after we finished that that development, I got a new job. Because I was self-employed when we did it. So again, I was pretty free, but I really needed a salary. So I went off and found a job as an employed broker at that point. So we kind of did it, got the knowledge and the experience of doing it. So I can really see things from an investor's or developer's point of view, because I understand their day-to-day, what happens on site. But I think what we had also at the time, I mean, how I was probably 24 or something at that time, 24, 25. I also think that my dad struggled a little bit with being level or, you know, in terms of directorship of a company with a 25-year-old. We learned pretty quickly that maybe we were better sitting in the stands watching rugby with a beer than we were on a building site together, trying to finish a development off. But certainly an amazing experience, definitely. And as, like I said, has really helped me get into the mind of a developer. And that really was when I did lie to my dad when he said, right, you can finance this and find the property and I'll do the work. I was like, brilliant. Completely lied to him. I had no idea what development finance was. I had to literally Google it and just ring up a ton of lenders and figure it out. We were quite lucky in the end. We actually got investor finance for the entire thing, plus the cost of the works, which was fantastic. We flipped the property on, everyone got paid, and we made a handsome sum out of it as well. But as I said, I learned all about this thing, development finance, bridging finance. And certainly it started to excite me that there was more to life than just mortgages.
I love it that you've got that development experience, and we'll come on to that private investor finance. But what we would love to talk to you about today, we're not talking rent to rent today. We're talking about buying assets and buying investment properties, buying HMOs, and especially advice for beginners, people who are starting off their property journey. What should people be thinking about, or what are the biggest mistakes you see when people come to you that newbies should pay attention to?
Well, do you know what? One of the biggest ones, which I've actually had twice in the last 2 days, is somebody coming to me and saying, Sam, I've just given up my job because I want to get into property. And that's real, you know, rolling your eyes out loud stuff, because I know that, you know, a lot of people will go on these courses and they'll be told, you know, get into it, put all your effort into it, become a property investor. But the reality is you've got to have a bit of a plan. And so one certainly bit of advice is, and this is purely just for getting mortgages, getting finances, keep hold of your job for as long, or your non-property income for as long as possible, because this allows you to do one or two things. A, it allows you to get mortgages and more of them, because if you've only just gone self-employed, you're probably going to have to wait for at least your first year's worth of tax returns in order to actually get a mortgage, which could derail your property investment strategy before it's even begun. But also, and this is kind of taking a broker hat off and putting an investor cap on, is the longer you can stop yourself from needing to take income from your property business, the more you are going to see exponential growth to that property business. I've seen so many of my clients, and I use this terminology all the time, the differentiating factors between a great and a good investor. And the great investors build their portfolio with their portfolio. Because, and you talked earlier on about money being a problem. Well, money doesn't have to be a problem if you keep buying more property and you keep then using the money that your properties that you already have are making to buy more properties. And it's just, you know, it's an upward spiral, and you can only make that work if you can hold yourself back from having to take income from that portfolio. Like I said, it's not just down to the fact that you will have greater opportunities when it comes to the financing options that you'll have available to you. I just think it's really good investment strategy, you know, to let that portfolio build. Because let's not forget, property is a long-term game. It's not a short-term thing. All these courses that are telling you that you're going to get financial freedom in 24 months, do not listen to them because it won't happen.
Well, you could possibly get to replacing a low salary within 24 months.
But that's the thing, is if you replace your salary and then you start taking that, you effectively go back to ground zero, because you're then having to, in terms of trying to grow the portfolio, you're taking that, but that's as far as you're going for the time being. If you can hold on for that, just that little bit longer, certainly have that as a goal. I always say to my clients, you know, have that as a goal. Try and reach that point where if you really had to, if you lost your job, you would be okay. That's an amazing feeling. But ultimately, if you could get it to 2 times that amount, or 3 times that amount, or 10 times that amount, think how much better that's going to make you feel. And then you can give up your job and only take a percentage of that income that your portfolio is making, and you can still use the rest to continue building it. So the longer you can hold off, the better. That's always sort of my number one bit of advice for investors starting out, because I have unfortunately seen the negative of that, where people have given up jobs and then suddenly they're going, Sam, I've got no income, what do I do? I'm sort of like, I wish you'd come to me about 2 months ago.
No, it's solid advice. I suppose we were in a fortunate position in the fact that I moved to an area which has very low living costs. So we were able to invest in the business substantially and live on the income really easily. Yeah. But, you know, that won't be the case for everyone. But sound advice is basically you need a plan that allows you to meet the needs of your living costs and also grow your business by continuing to invest in it. And you can't do... Well, you can do both at the same time, but perhaps you just need a plan to know that your business can sustain you.
Yeah. I always ask my clients, what's the next step for you? And where is that going to lead you in the long term? What's your ultimate goal? And I guess my job to a degree is to figure out the difference between those two steps. Step 100, which is in the future, and step one. Because if step 100 is... They want to own three properties and it's just a bit of a side project, then my advice to them for step one is going to be very different in terms of the finance products or strategies that we want to go with, to if step 100 is that they want to own, you know, a £1 million portfolio that generates 100 grand a year, which I know isn't necessarily the easiest thing in the world, but you know what I mean. So having a long-term plan and then reverse engineering that to find out what the next step is really important, because this is another thing that I see that newbies kind of get wrong. And again, this isn't necessarily a finance thing. This is just an investor thing, is that everyone's so keen to get number one out the way. It's almost like a relief. I've got my first project out the way. But I always say, and this is another question I get asked a lot, how much money do I need to get started in property? Well, I don't believe that's the right question. It should be how much money do you need to generate from your first project in terms of recycling cash, if that's your strategy, in order to do the same again? Because if you put all your, you know, all of your eggs in one basket with property number one, but that deal isn't actually good enough to recycle enough cash in order for you to do number two, or maybe even number three, then, you know, Is it pointless? Is it actually pointless doing that deal? Are you better off trying to look at an alternative strategy? For example, are you better off flipping a couple of properties to begin with to build up some what I call seed capital for your property business? Property is a business at the end of the day, and all businesses need some kind of cash. You know, when I started Grand Union, what did I need? Cash. I needed to do some deals. So what did I do? I rang all of my existing client bank. Anything I can help you with, because the first thing that any business needs is a little bit of cash through the door to get them started, and property is no different. So what some investors believe is step one actually might be step three, because step one and two might be, I've only got 50 grand. I actually need to flip some properties, because if I put that 50 grand into a BRR, am I going to be able to recycle enough to then repeat that process again? Probably not, especially in this market. So sometimes, as I said, what they believe step one to be might be step three, step four, step five. There might be some steps that we need to build in beforehand. So that's another sort of not newbie mistake, but certainly things I think that first time investors should be considering when they're diving into this beautiful world of property.
Yeah, I love that, because what you're talking about is you're not just doing the transaction, you're actually delving into what objectives people have. And this is why investors love working with you, and you've really taken off on Instagram and your phone never stops ringing because we're not used to brokers who really understand property investment to the level that you do. So I want to do a couple of things. I thought it would be good to talk about a few of the basics that if somebody was starting out and they were thinking about either starting off with a buy-to-let investment or, for example, an HMO investment, what are the key things they should be thinking about? And then I'd love to move on to maybe a case study of using bridging, because a lot of people do like the idea of bridging, but are kind of fearful of it. So it'd be good to talk about that. But let's talk about what are the basics for people wanting to get started with property investments, Sam?
Yeah, so I think so. I funny enough, I've been thinking about doing a video about this recently because it's something I'm saying a lot. Is I think you need to, everyone, you know, the buzz phrase at the moment is BRR. Everyone's talking BRR, buy, refurbish, refinance, or buy, refurbish, refinance, rent. Everyone keeps adding an R, and at some point, I'm not sure what the R's actually stand for anymore, but I still call it BRR. Call me old school. But BRR can take a number of different forms, and I think that what newbie investors need to be thinking about is what are they trying to achieve? Because this is another thing people always talk about, and this probably goes into talking about bridging a little bit, is people say, you know, why can't I use a mortgage when it comes to buy, refurbish, refinance? And I said, you can. 100% you can use it. But you just have to be wary of the kind of timeframes that you're looking at to recycle your cash. Because for me, there's kind of, to keep things simple, there's three ways of investing in property to build a property portfolio outside of rent to rent, which actually I'm a fan of, to be honest with you. I think it's a great way for investors to start, get a bit of cash flow before they start building their asset base. And I think I'm in a bit of a minority when it comes to brokers when I have that that school of thought. So for me, there's a tried and tested way. You build a 25% deposit through savings or whatever it might be. You go and find a property that's ready to rent, and you go and buy it with a 75% loan to value mortgage. Bish bash bosh, you're good to go. Now, if you're going to follow that strategy, and that's not wrong by any stretch of the imagination, I've got some of my best clients do that. For me, I think you need one of a few different things, or you need to consider a few different things. Firstly, is the income scenario that we mentioned before, because if your income's a bit dodge, it's probably going to be quite difficult to get a mortgage, because mortgages for first-time investors are a little bit tricky to come by. You need to decide as well sort of whether you're going to be doing it personal name limited company, because that will push you in the direction of different mortgage products. But you also need to consider whether you're a homeowner or not. Believe it or not, one of the things that lenders will actually consider when you're buying a property with a mortgage or a buy-to-let for the first time is, are you a homeowner? Because if you don't have any experience as an investor, they at least want to see, or the vast, vast, vast majority at least want to see, that you have some experience of paying a mortgage. You know, that gives them some comfort. So if you are going to look down that route and you're quite happy to save a deposit, buy a property, and then spend a couple of years saving another deposit maybe, and then doing it that way and slowly but surely building up the portfolio, which, as we were saying off air, will lead to an exponential growth eventually, because you will start, you know, churning more and more cash out each month. They're the kind of things that you need to consider. Obviously, you know, just a nice clean bill of health on your credit file won't hurt. Also, making sure that just little things like on your credit file, you're on the electoral roll. These things make a big difference when it comes to lenders. Computer says no style decision in principle. Application forms. We've actually had a case decline recently because a client took out a car loan 2 months ago. That's the only reason it declined. So just being cautious of maybe, you know, just your credit file just looking healthy, and maybe, you know, don't apply for anything within 3 to 4 months of a time when you know that you're going to be applying for a mortgage. So they're the kind of things you want to be considering there. Right down the other end of the spectrum, you've got your BRR, you've got your heavy, you know, expansion of a portfolio type scenario. And that's where we're going to be using bridging finance to purchase the property with. Generally speaking, the best rates start at 70% loan to value on these types of deals. We can get to 75, we can even get to 85 or even 90 for the right type of deal. In some instances, if you're buying a property that is genuinely below market value. And I say genuinely below market value because people think that if you're buying a property below what it could be worth when you've done some work for it or on it, it's below market value. It's not. It's worth that amount at the moment because it needs work doing to it. Yeah. We can get loans, and maybe we'll use this as an example shortly, where you can actually borrow up to 100% of the cost of buying the property, and sometimes even towards the cost of the works, because the lender could base their loan to value on the actual open market value of the property, mm-hmm. rather than the value of the property that you're buying. And we're doing one of those at the moment, which is really, really interesting. So generally speaking, 70-75% is what you're looking at, but you also need to be aware that most lenders will prefer to retain or deduct all of the interest for the entirety of the loan from what we call your gross loan. So that 70-75% is your gross loan. Once you've deducted your fees and interest, you're left with your net loan, and that's actually what you get day one to go towards the purchase. So essentially the difference you've got to make up as a deposit. So if you are going down the BRR route and you're going to need to use bridging in order to do that, you need to be aware that you're probably going to need more than just the 25% deposit that you have been probably led to believe that you need to get into property. So you need to be aware of that. But bridging comes with a variety of flexibility, some of which we've already mentioned. It's quick. There's no early repayment charges to repay it, which means we can refinance nice and quickly, and we can refinance pre 6 months ownership, where a lot of people believe that you can't. You can at open market value. You've just got to be very, very careful about the lenders that you choose for your refinance. And these bridging lenders can be a little bit more open. So if it is your first time purchase, you don't own your own home, you know, if you've got maybe some, you know, decent income or whatever it might be, you've got a clean bill of health in your credit file, us as brokers, we can present you in a decent light so that some lenders will still consider taking you on. So it is a bit more flexible than taking out a mortgage as well. Of course, you can flip these properties and you can use bridging for that as well. In the middle there, between the tried and tested and the BRR, is what I call a long BRR. And that is where if you are not necessarily too concerned about releasing the equity that you're, the value that you're going to build into that property through a refurb straight away, we can look at taking out a 2-year fixed rate mortgage. The thing that we need to be concerned with there really is how long is the refurb going to take? Generally speaking, when a surveyor goes round, if they believe that the refurbishment work needed to get the property ready to rent will take longer than 4 to 6 weeks, chances are they'll do one or two things. They will either go back to their lender and give it a zero valuation. That doesn't mean that the property is worth nothing. It just means it's worth nothing to the client, to the lender in its current condition. Or they'll give it a valuation, but the lender will put a retention on the loan, which basically puts you into a bit of a catch-22 situation, which is until you do the work, they won't give you the money. So but you need the money in order to do the work and you know, get access to the property. So that causes a few headaches as well. It's often in that situation that we do go, right, we've got no choice. We have to go down the route of getting a bridge on this, which is our kind of plan B on that. But as long as it ticks those two boxes, you're not looking to refinance straight away, and the refurb is not going to take longer than sort of 4 to 6 weeks, we can go down the route of doing, as I said, a long buy, refurbish, refinance, which basically is a 2-year sort of rolling period. And again, I've got plenty of clients that do that. And you'll find, as I mentioned before, as time goes on, you will start building this portfolio. It will start gaining momentum because the income that you're generating keeps going up, because with every property that you add, the business starts making more money. And you will find that instead of now waiting for 2 years, suddenly you've got enough cash before that to do another one. And suddenly you're doing more and more simultaneously. So if your plan is not that you need to, you know, buy 11 properties in a single year, like one of my clients did in 2019, just before the all this funny stuff happened with COVID, then it's perfectly feasible to go down a slightly, you know, longer path, but probably will yield similar results over a long enough period of time. So that's what I talk to newbies about. You know, what's your strategy? And then we fit, like I said, the type of finance that you need to that strategy. So, I guess that's always conversation number one. for me and new clients anyway.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I would just love to ask you, we touched on, you mentioned a few of your clients there. It would be great to hear about somebody who was new or newish in property, who started off with the BRR strategy. I'm glad you confirmed that it's two R's.
Two R's, yeah.
The BRR strategy with a bridging loan, because I think that's the holy grail for a lot of people who don't have necessarily a huge amount of funds, but could raise a deposit to do a BRR and also make a lump sum at the end, hopefully. But tell us, give us a case study so we can see how it works.
So I mean, I've got one particular client who is just he's kind of your perfect BRR type investor. You know, he invests in the north of England. The property values that he purchases for are not massive. You know, we're talking, I think the first one we ever did, I think it was 60 grand was the purchase price. So as much as, you know, this is where I just don't differentiate between clients. I quite like helping people start out. I've done multi-million pounds bridging and commercial finance deals in the past, and still do. But, you know, this, just because this guy was only needing to borrow 40 odd grand, it's fine. Didn't make any difference. It set him on a path where he is now really successful. Still works full time, by the way, even though I think he's onto property 5 or 6 now. Got a business partner, both of them extremely organized. That is a key thing. If you want to succeed in property, be organized, people. That's a key differentiator between the good and the great. But yeah, we did this on a retained basis, as I mentioned before. So interest and fees were deducted. Typically 2% lender fee is pretty standard across the board. That works out cheaper than if you do a one in and one out, which some bridging lenders will do, because the one out sometimes is based on the loan at the end rather than the loan at the beginning, which if they're adding fees and interest on, obviously gets larger. So tends to be cheaper to load it at the front, deduct it from the loan rather than pay it at the end based on a higher amount. And yeah, all the interest was deducted. I think at that stage, we're probably looking at around 0.7% a month, something like that, from memory. This was a couple of years ago now. And they were in and out probably within a 5-month period. Bought the property, renovated it, only needed a relative quick tartan turn, as we call it. And then we refinanced with a lender where they were able to offer an open market valuation for the property. So instead of it being restricted, some lenders, if you're refinancing pre 6 months, they will restrict it to either the purchase price as the valuation or the purchase price plus the cost of the works plus the stamp duty. That'll be the maximum valuation they'll give for a property. So did it open market value. They pulled out half of the money that they left in, and that was enough for them to go and repeat the process with the cash that they had available to them as well. So pretty much the perfect sort of in and out BRR type strategy. And yeah, with that particular bridge, the key things that made that a pretty easy loan was, A, as I mentioned, the organization of the client. It cannot be underestimated how important. Bearing in mind, these people say, oh, I haven't got time for all of that. Both of the applicants were full-time employees. In fact, one worked for the local council, so you can imagine kind of the hours that they were working. So they just had everything. When I needed ID, they had it. When I needed bank statements, they had it. You know, it's really good just to be organized with a basic pack of your own due diligence documents. I've got a client who actually has a pack on themselves that they sent out to me when I first spoke to them. And when she sent this to me, I literally was doing backflips. It probably would have hurt my back in the process if I've actually done that. I'm old now, but have all of your information ready. You know, this had details of all their portfolio, all their income, their bank details, their bank statements, their ID, their proof of address. Proof of address is like, you know, have 3 years worth of proof of address ready, because your broker is going to ask you for it, or you know, your bridging lender, if you go direct, they're going to ask for this kind of stuff. Have it ready, have it available. The quicker it's available and uploaded, the easier your broker's life will be, the easier the underwriter's life will be, the quicker the application will go through. Typically, we want to get all of this stuff ready prior to even submitting an application, because I know what a lender's going to ask. So before they even ask it, I have it ready. So we submit it to them before they even ask for it. Anything that doesn't look right, we annotate to make it look right. I had a client recently who they'd on their bank statements had a lot of money going in and out of an account that said Coinbase. Now, I know that was a cryptocurrency account. The underwriter might not have known that. So all we did was in advance, underwriter didn't even ask this question. Yeah. We asked the client, can you send us your most recent Coinbase statement? Did that, married up all the payments, annotated it physically, and then actually put it back through the scanner. So when it was sent, we even put a covering letter on top of that particular part of the scan to the underwriter to say, these are what these payments are. I know you're going to question us. This is what they are. Is that okay? Rubber stamped. That underwriting on that particular, that loan was done in, we submitted the application at 9:15 in the morning, and at 2:30 in the afternoon, the underwriter called me to say it was done.
Wow, so that is unheard of in the commercial world.
That's the level that you want to try and get to. That doesn't happen on every case, but we try and get it. We got a phrase we use, which is one and done. We want to send everything to the underwriter. They rubber stamp it, make their life easier. Most underwriters, we're talking about mortgages here, most underwriters are looking at 20, 30, 40 applications a day. Make yours the easiest one of the day, because that means they will understand it. They'll rubber stamp it. Even, you know, look, underwriters are intelligent people, but even you could be Sherlock Holmes, and if you have to deal with that many applications on a daily basis, your mind's going to be frazzled. So put the work in, put the effort in, get organized, and get everything to them in advance and make their life as easy as humanly possible. And that's what we did on this one that I was mentioning to you before. Underwriting on that one probably only took about 2 or 3 days. Valuation instructed, done and dusted, bish, bash, bosh, formal offer sent out, and over to solicitors, which actually brings me on to the next big point for newbies is, if you're doing bridging, do not, whatever you do, scrimp on your solicitor. Pay them as much as you possibly can afford, because at the end of the day, they are going to be the gatekeepers to you being able to get your deal done on time, or in a timely fashion, or in some instances, and I've had 2 horror stories in my career where cases have not completed because the solicitors have been crap. And it's not because they're bad solicitors, it's because they don't have experience of this type of funding. Bridging, development, it falls under commercial funding. And so you need a commercial conveyancer to help you out with these things. And the questions you want to be asking a solicitor to make sure that they know what they're doing is not, do you do bridging finance? Because the answer that you'll get, funny enough, would always be yes. What you want to ask them is, how many bridging loans have you worked on in the last 6 months? And can you let me know which the name of the lenders, please? Because if they can't answer that question, you know that they haven't done it. So always ask those questions. Always do your due diligence. Typically, you could be paying £1,000, £2,000 to a solicitor who has that level of experience. Every penny of that is absolutely justified and absolutely worth it. And I tell you what, it makes my life a hell of a lot easier as well if I've got a solicitor that knows what they're doing. So, yeah, a few sort of key things there for new investors to think about on BRR.
Yeah, I love that, because you actually went over so many points. There's so many nuggets I could go into, but just to summarize some of the key incomes when you're thinking about getting started and you're thinking about, you know, going to see a broker to get your first property. The first one is thinking about your income levels. The second one is considering whether you are a homeowner or not. The third one is your credit file, particularly beyond the electoral. And the other one is be organized. And I absolutely agree. I think after the first commercial loan application went in, of course, you learn what is required. And then thank goodness for Google Drive, and there's so many of them now. You can just have everything there in that folder for the broker and for the lender then. And that really does help. Although, of course, you've got to update it for every new application because they only want 3 months.
But you know what? I had a client recently, and probably one of the nicest people I've come into contact with. He can get a bit, you know, when things don't go quite his way, he gets a bit stressed out. And one of the things I mentioned to him was sort of organization probably needed to be a bit better. And you know, he did the best thing that anyone can do. I truly believe you shouldn't worry too much about the stuff you're not good at. Concentrate on the stuff you are good at and get other people to do the stuff that you're not good at. He recognized that organizational skills were not his forte. So he got a VA. who organizes everything for him now and actually put me in touch with her. We had a great conversation, got everything sorted, bish, bash, bosh, amazing. So for any of you out there that are listening to this that are just thinking, oh my God, the idea of being organized makes me want to be a little bit sick, just hire a VA to do it all for you. And it won't cost you that much, but I'll tell you what, it won't cost you any sleepless nights. That's for certain. And it will just make your life so much easier when you are doing these kind of things. And yeah, you can pick these kinds of people up pretty cheaply, and they're as organized a set of people that you'll ever come into contact with in your life. So well worth it, in my opinion.
Yeah. And then after you gave the things for people to think about when they're beginner, you then went into the case study about the bridging loan. That was interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's so good to hear about real life stories. And how much money would the person have needed to start off? Was it about 30 grand? I was trying to sort of.
Yeah, roughly. It was about 35, I think, because to be honest, the refurbishment on it, I think off the top of my head, was something only about 10 or 11 grand, maybe not even quite that much. But the things, there are some other costs to consider, especially with bridging, which people might not be aware of. I mean, obviously, you've got stamp duty that you've got to pay, particularly if it's a second property. You've got to be aware that even if we're inside this nice little stamp duty holiday, you still get your 3% surcharge that you've got to pay, which some people forget about. So that's one thing that you need to consider. Also, I've mentioned about solicitors. Obviously, they can be a little bit dearer when it comes to bridging than on a standard case. By the way, I'm not saying use that particular solicitor for everything you do. Have two solicitors. Have one to do your really easy standard buy-to-let mortgage refinances, and then get your commercial one as well. But you've got the cost of that. You've got the cost of a valuation, which in my experience, the valuations for bridging is a little bit more expensive than valuations for mortgages. So that's something to be aware of as well, because the surveyors, when they're going out to do bridging, they're not just doing a really basic valuation for mortgage purposes. They're actually doing a slightly lengthier valuation. They're actually looking at not just what the open market value is, but they're actually looking at what the 180-day valuation and the 90-day valuation is. And what I mean by that is, if you were forced to sell the property within 3 or 6 months, 90 and 180 days, what difference would that make to the property value? And some bridging lenders will actually base their loan on the 180-day valuation. And you might think, well, most properties will get, you know, sold within 6 months. A lot of surveyors, to save themselves a bit of bother, are writing on their valuation reports at the moment that it's going to take 6 to 12 months for this particular property to sell. They're hedging their bets. They don't want their head on the chopping board. So that's something to consider as well. Obviously, that the increase in the valuation cost, certainly something to consider. And the big one for me is that new investors don't know is you actually need to make a contribution to the lender's legal fees as well, which is something a lot of the time that people miss out on. And this can be quite expensive as well. I've seen it anywhere from £500 to £5,000, depending on the size of the deal. And the reason for this is people go, why the hell should I be paying for their legal fees? Isn't that down to them? Well, actually, you've got to look at it from the lender's point of view. The drop-off rate when it comes to bridging is a lot higher than for mortgages in terms of loans not going ahead outside of the control of the lender. So like I said, put yourself in the shoes of the lender, because the valuation might come back horribly, which means that the deal can't proceed. The borrower can pull out at any point. And I've seen it happen so many times. I've decided I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to do this deal anymore. It's just not for me. And the lender can't control that. So if you imagine, they'd have to be very, very unlucky, but you can imagine they start the process of 100 bridging applications, and for whatever reason, none of those go ahead. If they're having to stump up, you know, £1,000 or £2,000 per application to instruct their legal team, that's a lot of money over the course of all those applications that don't go anywhere. But hence why the risk is then pushed onto the borrower, and it's usually done by way of a fee that's paid direct to the lender, or sometimes they'll ask for a legal undertaking to take place. And what that basically means is your solicitor just needs to be in funds, to use a technical term, so that they can go to the lender's solicitors and say, I have on account, and I can confirm legally that I have on account enough money to pay you for your initial legal work. So please continue and do that legal work. So they're the sort of different ways that would happen. But it is another cost that you probably need to take into account with all of this. So when you go back and say, you know, how much money did they need to kind of get started on this? Yeah, they needed the deposit, they needed some money for the works, and they also needed the money to sort of cover off some of these other fees, which, you know, generally speaking, they can be around, you know, in total 5-10 grand sometimes, depending on the size of the deal, because the valuation cost as well tends to go up with the cost of the property. So if you're buying a £300 property, the valuation is going to be a bit more than if you're buying a £100,000 property, for example. So all things that need to be taken into account.
Yeah. So they had some money, which is achievable for most mm-hmm. people, either collaborating with other people or
yeah.
to save up themselves or investor finance. It's a very achievable amount to.
I'm pretty sure they borrowed part of that money from their parents as well. So, you know, it was a bit of a mixture of the two. And bridging lenders are much, much more flexible in terms of where the deposit money comes from as well. This is another added bonus that people don't really think about, because if you want to use angel finance, by the way, top tip, never say the words angel finance to a financier, either mortgage or bridging lender, because they will run a mile. That term scares them. But if you're using that type of finance and you want to get a mortgage, you are going to be pretty much declined everywhere you go. Mortgage lenders do not like you borrowing money elsewhere from a private individual. If it's a gift, great. Even then, they're not too keen on it. If you buy, the way they kind of see it is, if you can't afford to invest in this property, don't. So that's it. I know that that's pretty cut and dry and probably not the truth, but that's the way they see it. So, but bridging lenders, much, much more flexible. It can come from pretty much anywhere. I'm trying to think of an example. I think I've had a client where they were borrowing money from an investor in the Cayman Islands once. That was tricky, I'm not going to lie. I think the money, one of the times there was some money that was held in trust in the Isle of Man that was coming over, and we had to sort of de-envelope all of that and figure out, you know, as long as you can be transparent, because this is something that's pretty key, is whether you're a five-man band organization that does bridging finance, maybe as a family office or something like that, or whether you're Barclays Bank, you still need to do the same level of anti-money laundering checks, which basically is where's the money coming from to make up the difference between what we're giving you and the price of the property. And as long as you can be really transparent with that, and this comes back to the organizational thing, have everything ready, just have as much detail as you possibly can. If you are borrowing it from somebody and you know that you're paying them an interest, let's have the fee agreement or the loan agreement drawn up, signed, ready to go. You know, lenders want to know who this person is. They might need ID from this person. This is worst case scenario. This doesn't happen that often, but they might need to see bank statements. They might need to see the transfer of that cash. They might want to know where that investor got their money from. All of these things we need to take into consideration, because they are prospective questions that a lender might ask. And as I said before, the more questions that we can answer before they're asked, the quicker the overall application is going to be. And ultimately, the better it's going to be for everyone, because we're going to be able to do the application nice and quick and get the deal across the line.
Great. So they started off with around £35,000, and they bought a property that was worth £60,000, and they used a bridging mm-hmm. loan. And mm-hmm. can you remember, I know it was a little while ago, what they were able to, what would the revaluation was?
I think it was 95. I think yeah. it was 95, 90, 95, something like that. Because that's, to be honest, that's kind of been where they've headed. Their most recent one that we've refinanced, I think was 95. Maybe it was just 100. But yeah, I think that was the fourth or fifth property now that they've got.
Yeah.
And that's so then in 2 years, 2.5 years.
They got 60 grand out or mm-hmm. approx, or is that right? And then they got, that paid them back.
Yeah, so let me get the old calculator out. So what was it? It's 95 times 75%. So 71 to 50. So yeah, if they would have paid back 30 odd grand for the, or 35 odd grand for the bridge. Yeah, they've probably, the money that they've put in, they've at least got probably 80% of that back out.
They've got around the same, that 35 grand. So mm-hmm. they've now owned this investment property that's cash flowing paying for itself. Mm. And they've got their 35 grand back again to pretty do the much, same thing yeah. on yeah. another one. Even if they were down a bit, then they've got to fill a little gap. But that's exactly what many people would love to be doing. And that's exactly the sort of thing that you help people do. So,
And
you know, people can tell from the conversation how the level of depth that you have in working with people and your passion for it. So I would love to leave people with how they can find out more and how they can learn more about working with you if they want to, Sam?
Absolutely. I mean, look, first and foremost, I'm active. I post pretty much daily on Instagram. So if they want to come and find me on Instagram, I'm at the Sam Norris. I think they can see it at the bottom if they're watching on the video. And if you've got any questions, just send me a direct message. It takes me sometimes a couple of days to get back because I'll get about 30 or 40 messages a day. But yeah, it's quite busy. but I always reply to every single message. So if you have any questions, please ask. What you might find, though, is if you do send me a message, I may have a podcast episode or a post that I've done or a video on my YouTube channel that answers that question pretty specifically. So I may direct you there first and foremost. But if you do want to go back and have a look at all the library of videos I've got, I think I counted something like 30 to 50 videos, something like that, on my YouTube channel, covering all manner of different questions surrounding property finance. If you just type in Sam Norris, the property investor's broker, we were talking about this off air, I can't change it. I will change it at some point, but you will find me on there. And I've got videos ranging from how bridging finance works, how you can work out your maximum loan on a development finance facility, how mortgages for social housing works, HMOs, refinancing pre-6 months. It's all up there. So you'll probably be able to find the answer to your question. But as I said, if you want to reach out directly, Instagram's probably the best way to do it. I am on Facebook and even TikTok. I'm on TikTok as well, all with the same handle. Twitter too, at the Sam Norris. You'll find me on all of those platforms.
So Sam is the man when it comes to loans and finding the finance that you want. Sam, at the end of your podcast episodes, you always talk about chocolate.
Yeah.
So I need the listeners and the viewers to know, what is your favourite?
It changes on almost a daily basis. My go-to at the moment is I love a biscuit and raisin Yorkie. That's like, ooh. I said to the wife the other day, because you know when you're married, you have important conversations, serious conversations like this. I said, if you're ever out and about, Emily, and you're thinking, oh, I might buy my husband a chocolate bar, go for the biscuit and raisin Yorkie. Yeah, I'm never going to be disappointed. So I'd probably say at the moment that's top of the tree. But like anything, it can be toppled at any moment with something different. But that's the current favorite.
Phenomenal. I'm loving the sound of it.
What's yours, Stephanie?
I used to eat chocolate quite a bit, but I'm not so much now. But my old stable used to be the milk chocolate bounty, but now I'm more of a green and black 70%.
Oh yeah.
I've gone a bit posh. Oh,
I love dark chocolate. Yeah, dark chocolate is the way forward. And it's better for you. It's called the antioxidants and all that kind of stuff. Gotta look after yourself when you're a property investor and you've got to be thinking about things all the time and you've got to be healthy. So, just eat more chocolate is basically what I say to that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks, Sam. It's been phenomenal having you on the show. The amount of value you've dropped has been epic, and we've only just scratched the surface of basically what you do and what you can offer. So also thanks to you for listening and for watching. It's been amazing to have you with us. And until next week, have a great rest of the week. And remember, believe bigger, be bolder, be a game changer. See you next time. Bye for now. Thank you so much for being with me here today. If you would like more, we've written the number one best-selling book on rent to rent. You can find it at renttorentsuccess.com/book. Reviewers on Amazon have described it as the best rent to rent HMO book and also as a definitive reference guide and inspirational. Take your next step today and buy the book. You can find it at renttorentsuccess.com/book. And I'll see you again next time. Until then, remember, believe bigger, be bolder, be a game changer.